Sunday. And so a long time ago, I asked Carol to preach because she knows Old Testament theology very well. And I'm really excited to have her this morning. So thanks.
Thank you. Well, I am for sure one of those old people now who just can't help but belt out that song. I could just keep singing that all morning. But we've been following the story of the Bible, the overarching story of the rescue and redemption of the world by the hero, the one and only God. Sorry, those are my grandkids. I have to look at them. The hero of the story. His name is Yahweh. Later, he'll make himself known by another name, Jesus. But now, at this point in the story, we know him as Yahweh. And the other main character is, very broadly, humanity. Oh, I'm going to use this. There we go. It's been an emotional roller coaster of a story so far. It started out on a big high. Creation was very good. And humanity was blessed and in close partnership relationship with God. And then there was a big low, the fall. Humanity's rebellion and a curse that covers creation. There was the exile from the garden and separation from God. It gets even lower from there, because that's the nature of the curse, with this downward spiral of humanity reaching a state of total depravity. And then, despite a complete reset and new start with Noah, humanity is still hopelessly evil. So there's another new start. God chooses one man to grow one family that will become Israel, through whom God will banish the curse and restore the blessing of Eden to the world. But then that family gets enslaved in Egypt, but then miraculously rescued by God. And that's where we left off last week. Today we're picking up in chapter 19 of Exodus. Now, back in Exodus 3, when Yahweh first introduced himself to Moses at the burning bush on Mount Sinai, which is also called Horeb, he promised with an interesting play on his own name that he would be with Israel, that the nature of Yahweh's relationship with Israel would be that of presence with. And he gave them a sign that was going to be the proof of that. He said, back at that time with Moses on Sinai, that at some point those Hebrew slaves will stand here, he said, at this mountain, all together before me and worship me. And he was saying that when you see that happen, you will know with certainty that in the way that I just came through for you, I will always come through for you, that I will always be with you. So then in those chapters that followed the burning bush, we saw amazing miraculous signs, the Passover, the Exodus, which is that great escape from Egypt, deliverance through the sea, water and food provided, and enemies defeated. Now we're in chapter 19. It's 3 months after they left Egypt. And, sorry, I don't know what button I'm pushing. There we go. Verse 1 says, in the third month after the sons of Israel had gone out from the land of Egypt, on that very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. When they had set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain. Here they are, all the Hebrew slaves, former slaves now, standing at the mountain, Sinai, also called Horeb, standing before God at his mountain as promised. This is the proof. Yahweh, I am, is with them, on their side, their deliverer, protector, provider, their God. He is present with them, and he will always be present with them. This whole thing that just happened is the assurance that you can count on him to be with you. He tells them, when in doubt, look back at this. So now the Exodus is completed. This is the beginning of the next stage. Here's a picture of them, because I like pictures. The Israelites will stay here at Mount Sinai for a year. It will take the writer 59 chapters to describe this experience. We won't read them all today. It's the rest of Exodus, all of the book of Leviticus, and the first half of Numbers. They'll finally leave the mountain in Numbers 10, verse 11. But now they've just arrived, and Moses immediately goes up the mountain. This is where he receives words from Yahweh for the people. He'll go up and down this mountain a number of times until a tent of meeting is constructed, a tabernacle, where God places his glory, his visible presence, and then Moses will meet with Yahweh there. But right now, this is his first time up the mountain. Verse 3 says, Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel, You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. Yahweh's first message to Israel, remember. Let's just pause for a minute, look back, and reflect on what just happened. Let me remind you. Remember how I was more powerful than that greatest power on earth, he says. How I cared for you, and I brought you safely to me. You just flew right out of Egypt on my wings. And then he goes on, Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Moses, these are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel. The memory of what God has done, he says, should motivate them to obey and keep his covenant. The Exodus from Egypt was the great salvation event of the Old Testament. And notice how in Israel's salvation experience, they're called to obey. They are not called to obey in order that God might save them. The call to obedience comes after the saving. See how I saved you? Because of that, obey. People are often under the impression that Israel in the Old Testament was supposed to work for their salvation, but they are not called to obey in order that God might save them. They already have been saved. The law is the next stage in their relationship with God. It is what is expected of a people already saved. So like us, Israel did not earn their salvation by their obedience. But also like us, once saved, they are obligated to live in a manner worthy of their calling. Their obedience will show that they have entered into a covenant relationship with God, and their obedience is the only way they can fulfill their calling. What that calling is right here. It's next in the passage. But first, let's talk about what this covenant is that they're called to keep. There have been continual backward glances to the patriarchs, your fathers, they say, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to the covenant that God made with Abraham, renewed with Isaac, and renewed again with Jacob. If you recall, God promised Abraham land, seed, and blessing. And now God came and rescued Israel because he was keeping his covenant promises to Abraham. Israel, they are the seed, the offspring of Abraham, that God has grown into a great nation. He is leading them into the land that he promised to Abraham, where they will experience the blessing of God and be a blessing. What is about to happen at Mount Sinai is not entirely a brand new covenant, but a renewing and expanding of the covenant God made with Israel back when Israel was just seed held within Abraham. God's calling them into that covenant to be the next stage in the covenant that God began with Abraham. He's leading them into the land where they will multiply and be a blessing to the world. And ultimately, Israel will give the world that one promised seed or descendant that will reverse the curse and bring the blessing back to the world. So let's talk more generally about what covenant is and how all the laws that are tied up with it relate to the covenant, because there are a lot of laws involved in this written covenant. And we tend to not like the rules in the Bible. We often might think that God is being unreasonable or overbearing to tell people what to do and what not to do, but that's because we don't understand our relationship with him as a covenant relationship. So I first really thought this through when I was preparing for our women's retreat last year. So some of you women will find this familiar, but this metaphor really helps me. So we're going to do it again. In our culture, we have legal agreements, we make deals, we enter partnerships, but none of these are quite like biblical covenants. Probably the only relationship we have that is more or less equivalent is marriage. You still sometimes hear people talk about the covenant of marriage. And God used this metaphor a lot to talk about his relationship with Israel, so we will use it too. So think about how this sounds similar to a marriage ceremony. When God made his covenant with Israel, he talked first about the story of their relationship up to this point. And then there were statements of loyalty made, promises made, and agreements about how everyone's going to behave while in this covenant relationship. Now, in our marriage ceremonies, the behavior agreements are pretty general. There's some sort of, I will love and be faithful to you statement. And we assume we just kind of know what that looks like because we've seen a lot of marriages. But when we read through the covenant between God and Israel, we are surprised by how many of these how to behave in this relationship stipulations there are. But they hadn't seen a lot of marriages like this one. This was a new thing to them, and they didn't have ingrained expectations of what it meant to love and be faithful to God, or the ones they had were wrong, and they needed a lot of explanation. So think about this. When we say wedding vows, we declare that this person we're marrying is our special one. Toby, right here, my husband, is my chosen one. And I promise, because I am his special chosen one, there are things I will do and will not do. Lots of the details of the stipulations of that covenant are implied in whatever wording we chose for the love and faithfulness statement in our vows, because the details are just understood for the most part. But if we were to spell them out, for someone with no context for marriage, what specifically I will love you and be faithful to you means, it would actually be a long list of what sounds like rules. So let me show you what I mean. If I agree to marry Toby, which I did, that means I'll live in a certain way. It's understood, and so I started a law list here. It's understood that I will not sleep with other men, but also that I will not kiss them, hold hands, embrace for more than a certain number of seconds, go on dates with other men, share a hotel room, use Tinder, say certain things to men, which would be a long list of specifics if we were to list them out. I will live in the same house with Toby, share finances, discuss major purchases, share in household chores, put him first when he's down, be his primary caregiver when he gets sick or has surgery, spend the holidays with him, visit his parents, and on and on and on. This would be a long list. We know we're agreeing to a long list of do's and don'ts when we enter a marriage covenant, and we're okay with that, because we know they're for the sake of this relationship that we care most about. And they're not rules. They're a declaration of how we're going to live in this covenant to make it a rich and beautiful relationship and to protect it. Now, sometimes they act as rules in times when we forget what kind of relationship we really want, and we start to stray towards something that will hurt this treasured relationship. And in those times, the vows pull us back. Now Israel says yes to God and to the covenant here at this mountain. And as the story unfolds, you'll see God use the stipulations of the covenant in that way, to call them on their unfaithfulness in order to call them back into covenant relationship, this relationship they said they wanted to have with him. The one I'm in relationship with has every right to quote the vows I made and use them to pull me back. I think we'd all agree Toby would have every right to say to me, look, you can't sleep with that guy. You're my special one, and you said yes to that, so stop acting like you're not mine. And I would have the right to say that to him. And God has every right to say that to Israel. You said yes. Stop acting like you're not mine. That's what the prophets are doing later on in the story. They speak God's words to Israel. Basically, hey, remember those vows you made with me at the mountain? You're not keeping them. Come back. Sorry, I once knew how to use it. Okay. If they choose to enter this covenant relationship, God says, they will be God's own possession, a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. Now, God's own possession is sometimes translated as a special or treasured possession, which is probably a better translation, since he then says, for the whole earth is mine. Everything is his possession. But out of all those possessions on the earth that are his, you, Israel, will be special to me. And the kingdom of priests is a statement about the role that Israel will play to the rest of the world. A priest is a mediator, a representative, a connector. The priest brings the people to God and brings God to the people. And Israel, as a nation, will act as priest to other nations. Israel will be the people that connects other people to God. They'll represent God to the world and show the world what God is like. And they'll be the pathway through which those other nations can enter into a relationship with Yahweh. And finally, the holy nation. They have to be. If they are God's special one and they're going to represent God and his character to the world, they have to be holy. They have to be set apart and stand out as different. Now, this doesn't mean living in complete isolation from other nations, because they couldn't fulfill their priestly role if they did. But it's more the sense that they must live among, but stand out as very different. Some walls will have to be put up to prevent Israel from being changed and absorbed by the other nations. But openings must also be maintained to allow the sharing of the knowledge of God, the giving of the invitation, and the distribution of the blessing of God to the nations. This is some pretty important work. This is Yahweh's stewards in the garden kind of work. This is image of God work. So look, Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, I do. All that the Lord has spoken, we will do. And Moses brought those words of the people to the Lord. So there we go. Israel's excited about entering into this covenant relationship with God. And they agree to all these love and be faithful to stipulations. What a happy ending. But of course, when we hear this narrative as a chapter in the greater story, which is what it really is, we realize it's not really the ending, but we're just actually on the cusp of an increasing of the conflict of the story. Remember, the conflict was introduced in Genesis 3 at the fall, and the conflict increased with the generations that followed and the total depravity of the world at the time of the flood, the enslaving of the people that were supposed to be the redemption of the world. And you'll find out next week that we're not finished with this downward trajectory of humanity. But if you're reading this story for the first time, you don't know that. And this is presented as a happy, hopeful moment in the story, So let's pause in that and enjoy it. Let's look at the hopefulness of it. God is inviting humanity into relationship with him. The narrative is written with Eden language sprinkled throughout, as if by leading them into the promised land, God is leading them back to Eden, where they will dwell once again and be his stewards. A land flowing with milk and honey, where God will dwell with them, giving them important work to do in the world. By his side, according to his values, covered by his blessing. We are going back to Eden. Humans failed in the garden and continued to fail at an exponential rate. But the story of humanity is not over with our failure. God is a God of second chances, and we will find third and fourth and fifth. My story is not over with my failure. Your story is not over with your failure. God is all about new starts, forgiveness, grace, a new path forward into relationship with him and into his blessing. Now, when we get here next week, Mark's sermon is going to have us already in the land. So this is our last chance at anything in the first big section of the Bible, the Torah. So before we go today, we're going to jump to the end of Deuteronomy for a minute. These are the names of the books that make up the Torah, that first big section. They're the books of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. And at the end of Deuteronomy, Israel has entered the covenant, left Sinai, been a disappointment, wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. It's a whole thing. We're skipping it. But now, at the end of Deuteronomy, this is the next generation. These are the children of the people who stood at the foot of the mountain. And they're getting ready to enter this Eden-like promised land. Moses goes over the covenant with them, and they have a vow-taking covenant ceremony with Yahweh, like their parents did in Exodus. And in Deuteronomy 28, Moses lays out a long list of blessings and curses that will be theirs if they keep or break the covenant. The word blessing is used seven times, and then the word curse is used seven times, the symbolic number of completeness, right? Total blessing, like in Eden, if they're faithful to the covenant, or total curse. And then listen to what he says in Deuteronomy 30. Let's see. Deuteronomy 30, 15 through 20. I'll read you the whole thing, but these are the highlights. Verse 15. See, this is Moses speaking. See, I have set before you today life and prosperity and death and adversity, in that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments, so that you may live and multiply, and that the Lord your God may bless you in the land where you are entering to possess it. But if your heart turns away and you will not obey, but are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you'll surely perish. You will not prolong your days in the land where you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess it. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. So choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants, by loving the Lord your God, by obeying his voice, and by holding fast to him. For this is your life and the length of your days, that you may live in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them. That's so cool. This is what I mean when I say a passage is written with Eden language. If we had grown up reading these books in Hebrew with the sort of devotion they're meant to be read, we would know the words of Genesis 1 through 3 like we know ourselves. So that when we got here to Deuteronomy 30, these words would stand out to us as Eden words. which would, you know, trigger enlightenment. Like, oh, that's what's happening here. We can see most of it in the English translations, at least in the NASB. But you have to be tipped off to these words that are translated prosperity and adversity at the top. They're really just the Hebrew words for good and evil, or good and bad. So let's just learn them. They're really easy ones. Tov is good. Ra is bad. Tov, ra. Tov, ra. Tov is all over Genesis 1. But I think more significantly is that these words together are the words that are used for the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's the tree of the knowledge of Tov and Ra. And these other highlighted words are also words and phrases that were really important in Genesis 1 through 3. But in addition to the specific words and phrases, this is a whole theme here. The whole picture that's painted of the choice is a very clear reflection of the Eden trees. Remember, in the garden there was a tree that gives life and a tree that would bring death. Blessing covered the garden as long as they chose life. And how did they choose life? By choosing to live according to God's good instruction, just like here. The curse of sin and death covered the world when humanity chose it. Now, in Deuteronomy, as the children of Israel are about to enter the land, God says, I have set before you, this is verse 15, he says, I have set before you life and good and death and evil. Verse 19, I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. And he says, choose life. This is a second chance to make the choice between the two trees, the life tree or the death tree, the blessing tree or the curse tree. This is a second chance at Eden. God is so gracious. And then, last thing. It didn't really fit neatly into the outline of my sermon, but we're leaving the Torah. And I want to tell you about Leviticus. I want you to see the thing that opened my eyes to Leviticus. There are a lot of laws in the Torah. And as we mentioned, many of those laws are about how this community is to live within the covenant relationship with Yahweh. It's the details of what it looks like to love and be faithful to him. But a lot of it is what people have called cultic laws. And it's basically how to practice the Jewish religion. It's about the temple, priests, sacrifices, rituals. And it's hard to read through. It doesn't seem to really apply to us because we don't practice the Jewish religion. In fact, nobody practices it this way anymore because there is no temple, and you can't do it without a temple. So while there's some really good stuff in there, the details are admittedly tedious. But big picture, it's really important to the story. So real quick, let's take a look at how these temple laws fit into the story. If God leading Israel to the promised land is in some sense like he's leading them back to Eden, we should think about what's changed since that first Eden experience. A lot has changed, but the foundational change underneath it all is the corruption of the world by the curse of sin, and specifically the corruption of people by the curse of sin. That sin is a barrier and a problem. It's the reason they couldn't just waltz right back into Eden after they were sent out. We carry death, corruption, and curse in ourselves, and that kind of stuff has no place in Eden. Now, at the end of Exodus, a tent of meeting with God is built, the tabernacle, and it is for sure designed to be a mini Eden. If ever there was Eden language somewhere, it's there. It is the place where humans can enter God's presence. Okay, you should open your Bibles to Exodus 40 now. Okay, Exodus 40. Now, before this, there were just 7 chapters about how to build the tent and all the stuff in it. And then there were five chapters on the on the actual building of the tent and all the stuff in it. And it's very repetitive, but what it shows us is they followed the instructions exactly. And you get to the end of that, and God's visible presence cloud is clearly there. It's really awesome. But even though they did it exactly right, Moses tries to go in and enter it, but he can't because God is in there. So we're in Exodus 40. We're going to read verses 34 and 35. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Oh, don't look at that part. Keep your Bibles open. But now, the whole point of this tent was for people to get to go in and meet with God. But since God is in the tent, people can't go in. His glory presence cloud is too something for humans to be able to be in its presence. So what's wrong? Well, it's sin. You can't just waltz back into Eden with that sin curse you carry around. And then after this, there's the whole book of Leviticus, which is there to solve the problem. In Leviticus, God is giving them a way into his presence, and it's this cultic ritual law. People think Leviticus is boring, but it is the grace God gave to Israel in the form of a pathway into his presence. So now flip one page over to Leviticus 1:1. It says, "Then the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting." Now, Moses is on the outside, and God speaks to him from the tent of meeting, from inside. But then, flip all the way through Leviticus. This is better in a paper Bible. There's sacrifices, priests, purification, atonement. Flip until you get to Numbers 1:1. And it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tent of meeting." Moses is in there with Yahweh. Leviticus solved the problem. Leviticus gives access to Yahweh. Leviticus is a word of grace to Israel. Yahweh wants to be with his people, and he will make a way despite humanity's sin. The God of the Old Testament, the God of the law even, is a God of grace. And this grace just gets crazier as we get further into the story. I still want to tell you what he does later in the story. Because Leviticus was the pathway for a while, but what he does later is really something. Mark gets to do that part. But the new Leviticus is called Jesus. And he is a word of grace to you. Because Yahweh wants to be with you. And he made a way despite your failure. They call him Jesus. They call him the way. So our thought for the drive home. The book of Exodus provides Israel with a record of a lot of acts of God's love and power in their life. It serves to motivate them to covenant faithfulness. There's the great saving act of the Exodus, but also many smaller miraculous touches on their lives. So many reasons to love God. So what are those for you? So what do you remember from the story of the Bible and the story of God's working in your life that motivates you to love him and be faithful to the covenant you've made with him? And then also think about how understanding the laws as part of a marriage-type covenant relationship might affect your relationship to God and the way you see that. So, let's pray. Yahweh God, Creator, High and Exalted One, Most Holy, You are so great. You're so good. We are in awe of you. And we're in awe and humbled that you want to be with us despite our failure, that you've made a way for Israel in Leviticus, for us in Jesus. Thank you for the invitation to covenant relationship with you. Help us to understand the beauty and sacredness of that relationship. Help us to be faithful to you, to live in a manner worthy of that relationship and of the high calling you've given us. Amen.